I can't believe you asked me that.
You know what I mean?
Everyone, sorry for the delay there. BBS Radio has new software, and I don't know about you, but it fandangles my mind every time I have to try. So we'll hopefully get that intro going a little bit better. Thanks a lot for trying, guys. This is Dr. Carla Wills Brandon. Thanks for joining me on this exceptionally hot, sweltering night. Current Galveston temp is around 90 degrees with 90-plus humidity. And because energy costs have skyrocketed, we don't turn the air conditioning on until 10 p.m. Thank goodness we live in a well-built 100-year-old house that retains the cool. With that said, grab yourself an icy cold drink and join me for a walk to the other side. This is the show that talks about life and death and how the two are so related and how there is no end and how the journey is continuous. With all the world events taking place in the Middle East, how are you all holding up? I've been talking to relatives in Haifa by email and the stress seems to be increasing. So I hope everyone is taking time to just breathe. Turn off that damn television set. Meditate. Reflect. Walk on the beach. In the neighborhood park. Go someplace quiet. If you're living in the war zone, find sanctity somewhere. Somewhere. Talking about the mountains, that's where I escape. I escaped to some serious mountains last week. Can you say Alaska? The hiking was amazing, absolutely amazing. It was glaciers galore, gang. My hubby's sons and I hit the trails every day, and I took a short ride up to the base of Mount McKinley in a single-engine plane. If you all remember, there are two young women still up on that mountain. Lots of people are climbing that mountain, and they do not know what they are doing. Very, 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 very overwhelming experience. Along with this, I explored some of the spirituality of Alaska, and one place I visited was Iqaluit Village National Park. Did you know it was haunted? Did you even know about Iqaluit Village National Park? I didn't. But I had to go see it after I read about it, and from Historical Haunts Online, that's all you have to do is Google Historical Haunts. Here is a brief taste for you. Just outside Anchorage, Alaska, is Iqaluit Village National Park, and the Native American cemetery here is haunted, according to locals, by ghostly wanderers, the spirits of Eskimo ancestors searching for their belongings. The Iqaluit religion is a blend of Eskimo beliefs and the Russian Orthodox teachings introduced by Russian settlers in the 1700s, specifically 1741. So what happened were that Russian Orthodox priests came over and, of course, as happens so often, infiltrated the natives living in the area. It holds that when a person dies, his spirit wanders the earth for 40 days and 40 nights searching for his earthly possessions. To keep the spirits confined to the cemetery, the Iqaluit build colorful miniature houses on top of the graves. Each structure is topped with a distinctive cross of the Russian Orthodox Church. The many houses are painted with family colors and contain personal items of the deceased, such as cups, plates, spoons, a comb, a pipe, and even a rifle or a camera. And this place is amazing. It's absolutely amazing. You come across this cemetery, and you see all of these they're spirit houses, and they look like buildings taken out of Red Square in Moscow. They're absolutely delightful. Aaron Leggett, Dinalaya, and I'm going to say his name wrong, Dinaina Abascam. Aaron is a descendant of this particular tribe. Let me try this again. Dina-in-a-af-ab-askan Indian. Well, anyway, he took a look at this site, and he emailed the webmasters of Historical Haunts and further clarified why these Russian-looking mini-houses were built on top of his ancestors' graves. The reason, he says, that we constructed this spirit house is so that our ancestors had a place to stay so that they wouldn't be haunting people. We believe that these houses were for temporary use only until we had our judgment day. Also, he says, we are not Eskimos. You know, so many people think that most of the natives up in Alaska are Eskimos, and there are lots of different native people in Alaska. And so, you know, I learned something new here. And then he describes again that we are the Na-in-a-ab-askan Indians. I'm sure I'm massacring that. And we came to Alaska several thousand years ago before the group known as Eskimos arrived. We are genetically different from them, and our languages have nothing in common at all. In fact, there are more similarities between the English and the Germans than there are between us and them. If you have any questions, I would love to answer them. Thank you for your time. Now, if you want to see some great photo shots of these mini spirit houses, I'm going to encourage you to go to www.talesofeloise.com/gallery/eklutna. Or you can just email me, Dr. Carla, at drsbrandon@sbcglobal.net. Now, while I was hiking glaciers and looking at spirit houses and playing in the snow and just having a great time, an old acquaintance of mine made the news again. And I think it's very important to share this with you. This will tell you how our government works so hard at suppressing information, even at a military level. According to the Daily Record News, July 24th, 2006, title of the article is Man on Moon, We Saw a UFO Astronaut's Close Encounter. The first men to walk on the moon reported seeing a UFO. How many of you know that? A new TV documentary reveals. Astronaut Buzz Aldrin, the second man to walk on the moon's surface after Neil Armstrong, says space agency bosses covered up their sightings. And the Apollo 11 astronauts were also careful not to talk about it openly. On the Science Channel, a program called First on the Moon, The Untold Story was aired. This UFO sighting was discussed. Now, I need to tell all of you that I met Buzz Aldrin, one of the Apollo 11 astronauts. I lived for many years down the street from NASA, and I was on and off a base an awful lot, presenting information and lectures on drug and alcohol and domestic violence, and I would occasionally run into this guy, nice guy, and let me tell you, this is not the type of guy who's going to pull out of the thin air that he saw a UFO. This is a no-nonsense sort of guy. And here is the transcript from that program discussing the UFO sighting. On the documentary, the narrator starts by stating, 3 days and 200,000 miles into the flight, Mission Control did miss the significance of a cryptic message from Apollo 11. Apollo 11, do you have any idea where the S-IVV is with respect to us? Mission Control, stand by. Narrator, the crew required information on the current position of the S-IVB, the final stage of the rocket, which had been jettisoned away 2 days earlier. This short message hid an extraordinary turn of events. Apollo 11 wasn't alone in space. Now, no matter what your beliefs are about extraterrestrial activity, it's important to understand that you have not just Buzz Aldrin, but there are several astronauts over the years who have reported seeing UFOs. Buzz Aldrin, there was something out there that was close enough to be observed, and what could it be? Narrator, traveling alongside of Apollo 11 was a mysterious object like this one, and then he shows a ringed object at close range, filmed on a later mission. If it wasn't part of their own rocket, it could only be one thing, a UFO. Aldrin. Mike Collins decided he thought he could see it in the telescope, and he was able to do that. And when it was in one position that had a series of eclipses, but when you made it real sharp, it was sort of L-shaped. That didn't tell us very much. Dr. David Baker, Apollo 11 senior scientist. NASA knew very little about the object reported by the Apollo 11 crew. So it's obviously an unidentified flying object, but such objects were not uncommon in the history of every Earth orbit space flight going back over the previous years indicates that several crews saw objects. So you got several crews. Narrator, despite having a clear view of the UFO, the crew were wary of reporting it to mission control. Aldrin. Now, obviously, the three of us were not going to blurt out, hey, Houston, we got something moving alongside of us, and we don't know what it is. You know, can you tell us what it is? We weren't about to do that, because we know that those transmissions would be heard by all sorts of people, and who knows what somebody would have demanded that we turn back because of aliens or whatever the reason is. So we didn't do that. But we did decide we'd just cautiously ask Houston, how far away was the S-IVB. Narrator, unaware of the drama unfolding in space, Mission Control radioed the position back to Apollo 11. Mission Control, Apollo 11 Houston, the S-IVB is about 6,000 nautical miles from you now, over Aldrin. And then a few moments later, why they came back and said something like it was 6,000 miles away, because of the maneuver, so we really didn't think we were looking at something that far away. So we decided after a while of watching it, well, obviously they watched it for a while, it was time to go to sleep and not talk about it anymore until we came back and went through debriefing. Narrator, to this day, whatever it was that the crew saw has never been positively identified or officially acknowledged. Dr. David Baker, there were a lot of people within the program who went off later and became convinced that UFOs existed, and that led to some concern on NASA's part where they got the agreement of the crew never to publicly talk about these things for fear of ridicule. The program also talks about Aldrin using a pen to save their lives. I used a pen, one of the several that we had on board, that didn't have a metal end, and we used it to push in a circuit breaker. That's basically at one point they had to do that to make sure everyone was safe. So, speaking of science and scientists, I've got a real treat for you. How many of you have watched the Sci-Fi Channel television program Ghost Hunters? Have you ever wondered who develops those great spirit-busting and tracking devices the guys and the gals on Ghost Hunters use? Oops, I said busters, didn't I? It's hunters. I'm sorry, Dr. Ron. Dr. Ron Million, I hope I'm not massacring his name. He'll correct me when he comes on, is his name. If you want to take a peek at this good-looking guy, go to www.the-atlantic-paranormal-society.com/members.html. Educated with a doctorate in electrical engineering, he has worked with the design of systems involving electrical, mechanical, and thermal systems for both defense and commercial markets. Dr. Million has also been involved in the experimental study of electromagnetics, anti-gravity systems, plasma systems, radio communication systems, paranormal research and development systems, including EMF detectors, ion generators, PMVP, paranormal magnetic variation phase detectors, that's a new project, portable Geiger counters for paranormal research, and UFO detector systems. And as if this weren't enough, he has experience with advanced propulsion systems, experimentation, time travel research, and development of experimental electrical prototype systems, and during his spare time, as if he had any with all that going on, he is an assistant adjunct professor at St. John's University in the computer science and physics department. Dr. Ron has over 20 years of research and development experience and is the research and development director for Sci-Fi television channel Ghost Hunters. I love that show. My son and I, we watch it regularly. Good to have you here, Ron. Are you on?
Yes, how are you, caller? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you. I'm sorry about the confusion last night. Got there till 10:36. I'm so sorry.
Ah, no problem. Uh-huh. How was your trip to Alaska? Good?
Oh, it was great. It was awesome. So let's go ahead and get started. We have 45 minutes to cover all of the incredible things that you are doing, and I see that you are an engineering manager for a major DoD defense manufacturer which develops communications, navigation, identification, and reconnaissance systems. That sounds pretty complex. Is that your day job?
That's the day job, as they say, and we do stuff for the Department of Defense. So we mostly work on advanced projects for military applications. That's what the company's mostly involved with.
Things you cannot talk about on public radio.
Well, most of them are classified projects, but it's definitely for the benefit for the national security of the United States.
Wow, that's really, really something. I mean, I've been the shrink for several NASA folk, and I've had those guys in black jackets come visit me a few times with the security clearance stuff.
Yep. Yeah. It's all reference to what we call DoD 5500, which is usually classified information and stuff. But it's real exciting because it's bleeding edge technology that we're trying to think about. It's kind of like we work in a think tank for we call FCS. That stands for Future Combat Soldier.
Wow.
So we're trying to. Work on stuff. I'll give you just a quick example. Everyone now, of course, is Wi-Fi kind of hooked up, wireless internet and stuff. Well, that's based on 802.11. That's an IEEE spec. We're working on 802.16, which is really called WiMAX, but more for military applications.
Huh.
So you could go much further. It's a self-healing forming network, and you could do like voice over IP over wireless. It's some really cool stuff. So this stuff will eventually have filtered down to the I call it the consumer geek in a few years, but it's stuff we're working on. It's really cool.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. Now, how did you get into the paranormal research? I don't know a lot of folks at NASA. Well, I do know a few. Edgar Mitchell, he's a buddy of mine. He's kind of an interesting guy with noetic science.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very interesting gentleman there. It goes way back. It goes way back to when I was intrigued about the unidentified flying object phenomenology. And I've always been fascinated and always wanted to find out what's really behind this, unknown. And that's what really got me into more seriously into the paranormal sciences. I mean, I always knew about ghosts and stuff like that, but what kind of fascinated me when I was a younger kid, just getting into, good paranormal type of getting your feet wet is looking into the UFO phenomena, and I'm saying, man, it's got to be some explanation to this. You got all these people saying they saw these huge ships, with silent propulsion, no noise, making right angle turns. So, being naive as I was back then, just a little older now naive, and that's how it got me started. I'm saying, man, it's got to be maybe something we could do to get more information besides just photographs, So that's where I would start to tinker around with some ideas and concepts.
Well, what do you think about Buzz Aldrin finally coming clean and saying that, those guys have seen a UFO?
Well, depending on, when they're active in a mission state, I mean, there's stuff that they can't divulge to the public because, depending on the mission, if it's if certain observations that they see is considered under a classified assignment, obviously you can't talk about it because we all sign there's a special security paper that you got to sign, and they could definitely throw the book at you. So probably what happens was after a period of time when it kind of expires, we could say, then you could say, then, hey, let me come out. This is what we saw, and it wasn't terrestrial, wasn't any of our neighboring satellites. It was just something unexplained whatsoever.
Well, sort of like all of the Roswell military that came forward a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, yep. Hey, there's something interesting about the whole thing here is, trying to make a long story short, there was a gentleman up where I live here, on the East Coast, who wrote a book about Hudson Valley UFO sightings.
Yeah.
And his co-author was Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
Oh, wow.
And everyone knows him. I mean, he's the one that termed the Close Encounters of the First, Second, and Third Kind. And actually, he was in the movies, Steven Spielberg's Close Encounter of the Third Kind.
Right.
And he was also the main guy responsible for Project Blue Book, which was an Air Force type of, the Air Force investigation, which closed in 1969. But when they opened up the investigation, Dr. Hynek from Northeastern University, he was appointed to be in charge of that project from the Air Force.
Well, explain to the audience real quick, brief synopsis of Project Blue Book.
Every single type of UFO, legitimate UFO sighting that could be a warning to national security had to be investigated thoroughly, and it was the responsibility of the U.S. Air Force back then.
Right.
So even though there was Dr. Hynek was a civilian, but he was a consultant contractor to the U.S. Air Force. So he would go out and try to debunk, that's really the term we use, as best as possible about these sightings that people were seeing. You know, doesn't have to be necessary over a military base, but just, a real unknown sighting. And of all the, let's just pick a number, I mean, it's over this, but over 4,000 cases, there's about 735 cases they were never solved or classified as, unknown, to be determined. I mean, they can't classify where it belongs to.
So how do your fellow peers at your day job feel about you getting into the paranormal research end of things?
Keep it quiet.
You have to keep it quiet.
Yeah, like the old expression here, caller, under the radar.
Uh-huh.
Unless they do a Google on my name or something, then they say, wait a minute, what's this guy into? But I haven't had that come to me yet, so which is good. But I did have a colleague of mine who worked in my New Jersey office in Wayne, New Jersey, and he says, Ron, not for nothing. I saw you on television last night. Can you explain it? So I said, well, I'm involved with this, a bunch of paranormal guys, and I said, you got to keep it quiet. And he said, absolutely. He says, man, I can't believe we got a superstar in the company here. And I said, he's kind of joking around, but so far, no, people at work, I think they kind of maybe live a monotone life, one-channel life. They don't do any extra explorations, which is good for me. But if I do get confronted, I'll go, yeah, man, it's a hobby. It's something to keep the mind, open ears out there. I'm kind of an adventurous guy, so to check it out.
But how interesting that, your day job enables you to really probe the paranormal. So as the research and development manager for TAP, a.k.a. Ghost Hunters, can you tell the audience how you design, test, and research new technologies for tools to help these paranormal researchers do the work to collect and observe and
even
save
exactly
some of this evidence? I mean, I went and looked at some of the things you've been doing, and it's amazing.
Well, of course, this didn't start yesterday, but, there is a basic toolkit for different trades. You have the toolkit for medical, toolkit for, the attorney at law, his law books and references. So the paranormal investigator, let's say the classic ghost chaser or ghostbusters, they have their camera, a recorder, so-called EMF detector, so... And people go, okay, that you got these basic tools. So I look at the tool set and I go, all right, where are the? Is there any gaps? if there's any gaps, what can I fill the gap with? In other words, what's a better mousetrap is the term I always use. And then I look at some of the technology at work during the day and also other surrounding technologies, and I go, well, you know, if I could figure out, if I get a piece here and a piece there, and I kind of put this system together, hey, we got a new type of added tool. Now,
why don't you explain, because I know a lot of folks do know what the basic kit is, but there are a lot of them who don't. So maybe start with the basic kit and then move on to some of the more interesting things that you've developed.
Yeah, for example, just going out, I mean, using your organic sensors is the best tool. Look at me wrong. I mean, if you have your, you know, your five senses, and you know you're able to make a judgment, analytical judgment. You know, I mean, that's a great tool. That's your greatest tool is your mind and your body. But I mean, there are certain cases now that's outside our organic senses. And one mandatory thing to have is a recording system. Now, if you see something and you go, what was that? There was a black shadow or something. It's only good to you as the observer at that moment in time, but you can't relay that information back to someone else saying, I saw a black shadow. And then the person will say, okay, so what about it? So in a case for a paranormal investigator, I mean, at least as a basic mandatory tool, some kind of simple video recording system. You know, small, they got these cameras now that's so cheap. But besides that, you could capture that video, you could review it, and you could review it over and over. Then you could share it to other people in the communities out there and say, what is your opinion on it? Right. So the most important thing is this piece, outside your organic senses, you lose the information if you can't store it.
Yeah.
And you got to just trust your old memory and judgment. And that's the most that's kind of a very poor way of trying to really, say, prove something that's really, let's say, paranormal, or you know, that's above the normal is the term.
Right.
So you need at least a recording device. Now, someone just starting out, say starting tomorrow, will have an audio recorder. Well, the audio recorder could do two things. You could do is you could have an interview conversation with the person who called you in for the investigation, which besides taking some written notes, now you have a you could transcribe exactly word for word what the person's comments and living here for X amount of time, what they observe. It's a great it's a great tool to have. So you could go back, transcribe it, put a report together, and then you go, okay, well, we have, you know, these are the events that happen over time at this person's, you know, facility. Another good example of the same type of device is you know, you could just have it, see if it traps what we call electronic voice phenomena.
Yeah, describe that. I tried some of that in Scotland in a castle, and I didn't do very well. So describe that for the audience.
Oh, I'm sorry, Carla, you said you tried that and it didn't work?
Yeah, I didn't do a very good job.
okay.
It was in a castle.
Now, just because you didn't get anything doesn't mean you're doing something wrong. It could be there's the activity, there was no activity levels at that particular time when you were physically there. So in other words, can spirits kind of like turn themselves off or kind of say, well, you know, they're tired, so we're going to rest tonight? It can be. It doesn't mean because something claims to have abnormal situations or paranormal, doesn't mean guaranteed that it's always going to be constant activity. It's just the how the energy state, I call that, of that dimension or those of that particular hemisphere of energies. It might not be at that particular time when you're at that time. So in other words, we call it in phasing. Phasing means when I'm here and then this is a haunted situation and the energy is in existence and gives me signs of presence by either physical, mechanical, or maybe by electromagnetic. In other words, energies that I could measure against, then we got something going on right now. But sometimes, and a lot of times, it could be what they call just in a idle state, nothing going on at all. We were down at Eastern State Penitentiary investigating for the third time. That was filmed in season two. Absolutely not one piece of evidence at all. And I brought down some really cool prototype equipment that that if anything was going by it, any kind of something of composition, it's like some kind of mass composition, it would trigger this alarm system.
And didn't last time you get a lot of activity?
And the time before, it was more personal, a lot more activity.
Right.
And this goes to show you that depending on, I call it their energy state at that time, it's just unpredictable. You know, I don't know if like, you know, hey, they have a union meeting that night and they all just have to go there, or it's just the way the conditions are set. It's just very, very fascinating, which there's very little data on that. It's what they call some kind of predictability of the paranormal status. In other words, every so often at a certain time, there will definitely be, you know, guaranteed energy form. No one really has any conclusive studies on that yet, which is
a
pretty interesting thing to look into.
You know, what I'm hearing you say is that it's unknown why sometimes you get something and sometimes you don't, but the skeptics will take that and run with that. And so what that does is that it makes individuals like yourself who really are into, you're not new agey, tie-dye, misu drinking, whoa. I mean, you really want to research this stuff, and it tends to make it more difficult for real true researchers to go in there and do their job when you've got to deal with the skeptics.
And the only way to really answer those skeptics, like to really like kind of come back with some a really good, say, front of answers, is that what I say is that, no, this is always an ongoing research investigation over periods of time where there's enough data gathered over periods of time that now we can make some kind of final report on all the data that we captured. We can't do it in a week. We may not be able to do it in a day or a month. It might take over a period of many months to finally get all our, you know, our data together. So that's kind of the more of the answers I give out to, like, when we do presentations and lectures, is that you can't come to a conclusion, you know, within 24 hours. It's always, no matter how small or simple, you know, it might be a place under question, or how large a complex, like Waverly Hills or something huge like that, it's going to take a lot of repeated, I call baselining and trying to gather the data. And the more data that you could capture, eventually you could build some kind of maybe pattern, what we call the patterns.
Right.
And if you get enough patterns out there, then you can make some kind of conclusion saying, okay, this is definitely, you know, above the normal situation, this location here.
So go ahead and continue telling us what else that you need if you're going to go out there and if you're just a basic person and you're going to go out there and take a look at some of this stuff. You got a house down the street, and it's, people have seen things that are unusual, heard things, and so we have a recording device, a video camera.
The other thing, too, is the most important thing is you got to kind of like do a field survey. In other words, when you go down to an investigation, you got to kind of have to play multiple hats. In other words, you might have to play everything from, you know, like they say, an inspector of a house, or if you're like, they call it the house engineer. Come in and you look around and you go, okay, let's see, there's old water pipes here and there's an old heating system here. And, boy, this wiring goes back 60 years, and it has all these antique switches. You really have to go and kind of be formative or well-rounded about knowing basic architecture of our house and what type of wiring is to, that's used in new construction compared to old construction. I'm an electrical engineer by trade, but I'm saying There is stuff that's done by what we call electric code, and there's stuff that's not done by electric code. And then you could cause, leakage, electrical leakage. And electrical leakage could give false positives. So if an investigator's there saying, hey, I got these real high readings in Jonathan's room, which is directly a floor above the, say, the electrical wiring closet, and because they have a very poor grounding system, you know, they didn't go by the local California, let's say, electric code, that there is very high, readings. And high, we call electromagnetic readings, usually tends to have a biological effect on human beings, such as nausea, headaches, sometimes you could even become delusional. Huh. And that maybe causes the false positives in that person, and the person thinks that something's paranormal, something is crazy, as they say. But wow. It's due to the environment itself of the dwelling that it's, poorly constructed. So you have to do is you have to go, and before you pull out, the recorder, the video, the microphones, or even the electric analyzers, just kind of do a field survey, look around the house. Legitimate question is, how old is the house? Where was it constructed on? Oh, they just moved the Indian cemetery about 70 years ago, and they buried this whole new, complex of houses on top of it. All types of stuff like that. The outside, the inside. Maybe there is they have some of these houses are like 200 feet away from a high powered, transmission power line bus, we call it, and that gives off a tremendous amount of interference.
So my house is almost 100 years old, and my office house was almost 100 years old. You definitely want to come in. If I said to you, because I did have a couple of patients who, they actually saw a man materialized upstairs. You have patients running. It's not good for business.
That's right.
But you definitely would want to know the structure of the place, how old it is, the wiring, leaking pipes, and then things that someone like me, I'm not even going to know. You have a doctorate in electrical engineering, so you're going to know what to look for.
Well, yeah, exactly. But it doesn't mean that you could just basically pick up some just simple journals, simple books, say House 1, 2, 3 or something like that, or House Construction for Dummies, and spend an hour or two of reading, and you get enough good little general information. And it won't take you long to now to know the major points out there.
That's
in other words,
really good advice.
Yeah, so you could tell. I mean, you could tell when you walk into an old house or a new house. I mean, just by if you look at it and the guy says, "Well, this house was built in 1922," right away you could do a simple math and you go, "Wow, it's over 80 years old." Anything upgraded?
Now, what other things have you developed specifically? What kind of things have you come up with for taps, for instance?
Well, there's something new that came up that right now there are on the high end stuff. There's something called an infrared camera or infrared imaging system. Well, that could detect hot and cold spots. That's a pretty sophisticated tool. They use it in a lot of different industries, but it's very very expensive. I came up with something cool, believe it or not, now no pun intended, but it's called the PhD, the Paranormal Heat Detector.
Okay.
And what this is based on black body radiation concept, which means that all the heat and all the heat surrounding this surface object is kind of enclosed or is kind of incident to it, and then it reflects stuff that the temperature goes up a little bit further and further. So everything gives off some kind of we call background or black body radiation.
Wow.
So what this device does, I send a beam down, and I have it where the system is calibrated or threshold to about 100 degrees Fahrenheit, just approximately, which is like you and I's body temperature. human body temperature. So the so there's enough aurora, or what I call thermal heat from some human being's body, that the black body constant from your body, this device will pick it up and it'll set off an alarm. Now, the application really behind it is not to bring them into a small residential house, but these are for in large institutional where there's no power, lights off, it's pitch black, the place is totally empty, it's just you and your investigation team. So then you go down and you got this long corridor hallway. So you take this device, so that long corridor hallway, there should be no human beings or nothing at all down there. Now, if the device picks up something that's hot surface, like, say, 100 degrees plus, it's going to trigger.
Huh.
Now, is it an entity? We're not saying it's an entity, but what we're saying is that there is some substantial temperature radiant in that general area. So that'll give the investigator, like, okay, now we all know that in human spirits, has more of a higher temperature than a regular, say, an intelligent haunting, which is, gives more cold spots. So it's inversely proportional. So inhuman or demonic is more higher temperature is what the cases that they've been observing over the years. So this device is really aimed to look at more of like not cold temperature spirits, but kind of high temperature spirits or inhuman spirits.
A lot of activity.
And also, at the same time, is, you know, if there's any other, you know, is there anything else down there? In other words, is there an animal? And which it'll pick up, you know, it'll pick up something, you know, if a rabbit's hanging out down that hallway, just keeping, you know, trying to keep a little bit warm for the winter time, this thing hits that, you know, fur coat of the rabbit, and the rabbit's about, you know, just about 100 degrees also. She'll go off. So in other words, it also helps you debunking. So
right.
Say, okay, this place is supposed to be isolated, but now there is some animals who are living in there, and this is maybe the cause of the person who's complaining or the security guard that does his rounds of paranormal activity.
I think it's so interesting that here you are creating these incredible gadgets and sophisticated technology in order to do this work, and this is the sort of thing that we rarely hear about. I hope that you'll continue doing your work. Now tell us about some of the other things that you're doing.
The other thing is that most all the investigators out there, I mean, because we can only see the visible spectrum, we can't see outside it. In other words, we only could see, you know, our color spectrum, yellow, red, blue, green, which within a specific, you know, frequency wavelength. Now, when you go outside and you get the good old summertime that it is now, when you get your sunburn, it's your ultraviolet, you know, radiation there. The other spectrum on the other side is the infrared. Now, these all make up electric and a magnetic wave, which we have what they call as a, you know, say, a specific energy state. So a very classic tool that all the paranormal investigators do is they take a device called a electromagnetic field detector, or EMF for short, and its main objective is to see if you have pockets of electromagnetic energy states.
Huh.
Now, the thing is that over the years they've been using this tool. They go around and they'll say, okay, I'm going to John's room and anything that's below, let's say, a 3, let's just throw that number out just for now for simplicity, you know, it's kind of we call a normal state, you know, just regular background, little electromagnetic, we call it the noise floor of the environment. The disadvantage about all that is that you don't track that data. So how do you track it? You might have to have a partner with you and say, oh, look, we got a 6.2 or 5.5, and that was in Mary's room on the second floor.
Right.
Well, I came out with an EMF system that it automatically records all the energy in, states, in other words, all the pockets as you're going around, and timestamps it into, I call it, you know, like a computer/RAM system on board inside the EMF housing itself. So it's almost an EMF like mini computer. So let's say if you're going around for 20 minutes in two or three rooms and you have, you collected like 450 collection points, let's call it, you could download that data to a laptop and it will graph out. It'll tell you that, you know, you had low, 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 low. Then you had five or six major spikes. And then you could say, okay, those five spikes were was exactly at this time because it's time stamped. And then you could go back to that spot. All you had to know is what spot it was, you know, what area. Everything else is just recorded. So you could go back, graph it, and you could go back and reinvestigate the same area and see if you get the same pattern of data again. So now we have, I came out with this storage EMF detector system.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing.
I mean, it took a lot of thinking, a lot of kind of slick engineering, but I'm saying, wouldn't it be great if you could just capture the EMF readings? Because it's almost impossible to write it down, because especially if you're in a pitch black area and you have just a very little bit of light, and you're just not going to stop. You'll be sidetracked, and then you want to try to write it down, and you'd be like, well, what was I thinking of? Because you're constantly interrupted. Here,
right.
You just focus on going to the, you know, just doing a sweep, I call it, do the EMF sweep. You can go one room to the other, and everything is self-containing. It's recording, it time stamp, and you could go back later on and you could do your analysis. And you could have it reviewed by different members of the team that wasn't physically there at the investigation.
So what are some of the really, really interesting experiences that you've had on the show or in your work out in the field? What are some of the things that have just taken your breath away?
Well, feel a, what would they say is the air density dramatically changed real quick as being like we call the heavy air. When I experienced quite a bit of that when there was some activity, which is interesting where the instrumentation doesn't pick it up. So, for example, in the EMF detector, which usually will be directly proportional, in other words, it should climb up as we're getting close to a pocket of energy. Now, it's interesting, the air density changed to make it more heavier as far as what I'm feeling, which means that there is some energy increase, but the EMF detector itself did not. It was still flatlined. It didn't register anything.
That's interesting.
So your instinct itself, your biological organic instinct, is picking up like a real heavy density of air. And then as you moved through the place, it went back to like, call it, you know, just back to its normal, air environment. You know, but it seems like you run into these, like, almost thick density air pockets. And usually in those situations is where the evidence does come true. In other words, later on, a piece of footage might capture something like a real quick shadow or something, and if something changes the illumination composition, I call it. In other words, when we're running the infrared camera.
Well, years ago, I was at Raymond Moody's house, and I did some of his Theater of the Mind. And I actually, I went to three of his, he had these Theaters of the Mind created where it was all dark, and there was just a mirror hanging there, and, you know, I went and I thought, this is a bunch of baloney. And there was a fourth one left, and I thought, well, you know, I might as well go take a look at it. And I had an experience where the air, you know, suddenly lowered in temperature. And there is a feeling of the air. I don't know how to explain it. And I did see a lot of energy, spirit activity too. But the air, that sense of the air, that's something that I remember the most.
That's right, and it's what's interesting is that there is more. It seems like there is a device called like a ion analyzer, because you have the ions in the air itself between a positive and a negative side. So that's a really good device, which is more of an industrial device. But that could probably would be helpful when you have these, you know, when you have this, you know, these air pockets, let's say, the air density changes. Be interesting to see that the how the ion density analyzer would make that same change also, which it should. But it's all adds to more of a of data of collecting data, saying that yeah, when you do sense heaviness or something like that, that there is sign of maybe something's materializing. You know.
Yeah, that was very strange. Now I wanted to ask you about the Philadelphia project.
Oh yes, me and good old John Hutchison, which is on your coast.
The Gold Coast.
Yeah, he's he's directly north of you.
Where is he?
Well, actually, he's up in Vancouver, Canada.
Oh, okay. I see.
What?
Oh, okay. Oh, no, I was visiting Alaska. Gosh, no, I don't live there, though I'd love to. Well, explain to the audience briefly what the Philadelphia Project was.
It was a project that was back in 1943, which was called Project Rainbow. That's the actual code name. They all have these, you know, cute code names. And it was the objective of the experiment was to help reduce the magnetic footprint of the ships. Now, we'll say the ships we're talking about are U.S. Navy vessels because we're at the height of a war. Because of all the electronics on board the ship, all the wiring, the communication systems, the generators, which has got to supply the lights and, you know, keep the refrigerators running, gives itself off as a pretty powerful, I call a magnetic bubble, the ship itself. During the peak of the war, the Germans had these mines, and these mines would be triggered by anything that that would have a strong enough electromagnetic, say, punch to it. So here you have a U.S. Navy ship going through the waters, and then we can't pick up, we're not picking up anything from our equipment, surveillance equipment. So there you have this ingenious German mine explosive device, and as soon as the ship has enough magnetic footprint, it acts as the trigger or the igniter to the mine. Mine explodes, and now you take down the Navy ship.
Wow.
So
what are you guys going to do?
So the big thing was, or the big push was, hey, guys, you guys got to get together and you got to do this. We got to figure out a way to make it invisible to A, radar, and B, these mines. And this is where they said, let's get, you know, some of the best heads in the country together, and let's see if we can change or reduce or shield or shift the magnetic footprint of the ships. And what they did is they picked up a guinea pig, of course, and the guinea pig, of course, was what they call an escort ship, designated as DE-173. I mean, every ship has a number, and that number tells it what type of ship, classification of ship, the tonnage, in other words, how much the size, the weight, the beam, which is the width, etc. And the DE-173, its official name was the USS Eldridge. And what they did on that boat was the experimental boat to try to see if they could reduce the magnetic footprint so we don't set off any of these mines out there. So they put quite a bit of number of few high power generators, and what the term is called degaussing. The concept of degaussing is to reduce the magnetic field. Now, a typical example of how I could tell what the audience could do is, you know, most of the people that have computers and have the old, you know, they have the monitor. I'm not talking about the plasma or the flat screen today, but the classic, you know, monitor, you know, the big tube. There's a button there usually for, and you press it, and you could see actually the image shift, like go back and forth a couple cycles. And actually, what you do is you're degaussing the monitor, so you're reducing any electromagnetic strays buildup. So that's what they were trying to do on a ship. They're trying to do is manually, artificially degauss that ship to reduce the magnetic footprint.
We're getting short on time. So were they successful?
Well, let's put it this way: There was a huge green mist because that was we call a hydrogen breakdown to a free radical. That mixed with the sodium and the chloride breakdown in the salt water, and hydrogen chloride under a high electromagnetic field produces a green effect, like a glowing effect.
Oh,
now the actual ship was almost totally covered in this green glow of an umbrella, and when you're under a high electromagnetic umbrella, the human being in themselves, since we're made out of mostly water, you could actually get what they call as RF burns, radio frequency burns.
Oh,
and
wow.
if you're in the middle of a high intensity field, you could actually have your skin starts to decomposition or kind of break down.
Well, that's not a good thing.
So can you become part of a structure? In other words, kind of like glued to that surface because of the electromagnetic burns? Absolutely. Well, there were some people involved, some people on that ship where they had such very severe burns, they were kind of like part of the ship. Well,
really?
Some cases they go, they exaggerate, but absolutely they had some situation.
So
the only kicker to the whole thing is, as far as teleportation, in other words, was it transported to Norfolk, Virginia? In that situation, I don't agree that it was teleported, but it was kind of causing a jamming to the X-band radar, and that's what they were using back in the 43. So when they were trying to shoot the radar at it with this big green phosphorus glow, they weren't getting any radar tracks back because it was being totally, we call multipath. It is totally distorted. The ship acted as a jamming system because of the electromagnetic field. And people got really biologically sick and biologically troubled.
So what are you and your friend going to be trying with this? Are you going to be...
Yes, we're going to do it on a small scale, John and I, because we're going to have the same type of footprint there, which when I'm trying to degauss a small model ship and just fire it up with high electromagnetic fields and see if we could actually, we call redshift it. That's what they really wanted to do. In other words, redshift means optically, if I look at it, it's not where my eyes thinks it is. It's,
right,
say, 60 degrees to the right. So we call that a redshift effect. So we're going to try to see if we could make it immune to X-band radar. See if we could do a gelification, in other words, changing of the metal structure, and also see what it does when it's in a bath of, chlorine, salt water under that high electromagnetic field.
Well, Dr. Ron, that is amazing. And I want to share with the audience really quickly some of your other projects. It looks like you have an ECM handbook, and it looks like you have another book titled Introduction to Radar Systems, and another one called Stealth Radar. And people can find you at www.global-communication-networks.com/. And your email address is ron@the-atlantic-paranormal-society.com. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Absolutely. You'll look forward to having me on again. And when they go to the website, the Global Communication Networks, you'll see right there, they could go right to the Philadelphia experiment with details. You go to John Hutchison's site, and there is pages and pages and pages of actual fact and data about that case and the facts behind it and what we're trying to accomplish.
You're going to have to come back and tell us what happens with your experiments with the Philadelphia experiment.
Absolutely, once we don't get teleported.
Go ahead and tell us what time Ghost Hunters is on the Sci-Fi Channel.
It's on Wednesday nights at the 9 o'clock spot. They're kind of 25% through season 3 filming. They're going to be going overseas to do a couple of shots, but I'm going to be on this side of the water for a change. And we're going to be back up and running like August 21st. They're going to kick off the season 2 again. So it'll be out in the fall, like usually October, just about the first week of October will be the first release of season 3, just in time for Halloween season.
Of course. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so
much. Oh, thanks, Carl. It's been great. And, boy, man, time flies when you're having fun.
It sure does. I learned an awful lot tonight, and I'm sure the audience did, too. I learned things that I never would have even considered. It always helps to have someone around who has a PhD in electrical engineering. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, and have a good night.
Thank you. And to you, the valued BBS listener, if you have a comment about tonight's show, post it on the BBS Radio TNT message board or email me at drsbrandon@sbcglobal.net. And check out Dr. Ron's site and the Philadelphia experiment. We didn't get to get into it too much, but what he's trying to do, it's fascinating. So I'm going to give out his site again. It's www.global-communication-network.com/ or email me, and I'll be glad to give it to you again. Also, again, if the events of the world are beginning to overwhelm you, remember, life is a journey, but it's also a one-day-at-a-time journey. Remember to turn off the television and put down the newspapers if you begin to feel overwhelmed. This is Dr. Carla Wills Brandon, your afterlife travel guide, and you have just taken a walk to the other side. Sleep deep and sleep sweet. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.